Sending emails to me, wondering where these videos actually are. So these videos, actually, the problem is there are multiple platforms, right? Our general, like, IT infrastructure provider, RRCE. Okay. Today about camera calibration. Last time we talked about cameras and optics, and actually, there was one slide last week. I can show it to you quickly. There was one slide last week showing a camera obscura. Well, sorry. Sorry for that. Okay, you remember this camera obscura? It's like a building with a little hole in the wall. Actually, I found one yesterday in Nuremberg. Erfahrungsfeld der Sinne. Or so, whatever the long name is. I think this is the short name, but it's still awfully long. So it's at Werderwiese. There's actually a camera obscura, and it's really nice. I was in there. There's also a So the pinhole, you can adjust the size of the pinhole, and you will notice that if you have a big pinhole, then okay, at least some light comes in, but the picture is awfully blurry. So you always want to make the pinhole smaller, but then of course less and less light comes in, and it scales quadratically because you're reducing area. So it becomes super dark, and you have to sit in there for a long time to adjust your eye to the darkness. But then the picture is much sharper. So there's some reward actually in waiting for the low light picture. Yeah. So if you happen to be in Nuremberg sometimes, that's really a cool thing. I mean, it's intended for kids, but it also works for adults actually. No? Okay. Good. All right, let's talk about camera calibration. So, camera calibration sort of picks up where we left off last time. So we said if we are trying to understand our geometry in the world a little bit better, with the goal of answering a couple of specific metering questions on the objects in the world, like how tall is this woman, what is the height of the camera, what is the position or rotation of the camera in the world, things like that, then we need to understand what the imaging, the relationship is of mapping 3D objects in the scene onto the 2D sensor. And we use this projection model where we say, okay, the capital X, these are the 3D coordinates in the world of objects in the world. Lowercase x, these are 2D coordinates on the image sensor. And we have a relationship between those points that, with few simplifying assumptions following the pinhole model, we can say is a product of extrinsic parameters, so the rotation and translation of the object in the scene and intrinsic parameters in this matrix K that determine the way how we map in the camera the picture on the image plane. Like, for example, where's our optical center? So what is the translation of the optical center? Do we have some skew in the image? These are all intrinsic parameters expressed in the matrix K. And an important factor, certainly for the scale of this whole thing, is the focal length. That is what we talked about yesterday. Now, the goal of the camera calibration is to determine all these parameters such that we have the pose of the camera, but also the intrinsic parameters, such that we have a full description of the mapping of 3D points in the scene onto the image sensor. Yeah, so this is what camera calibration is about. Okay. Good. So first of all, let's do some math, and then eventually we talk about the calibration. So and let's characterize the type of transformations that we might be interested in between points. So loosely saying, okay, we all know what a transformation is. It's some, as expressed here, a coordinate changing machine. A transformation of a point P is a point P prime. And a global transformation means that we apply the same mechanism to all points P in the scene. And why might we be interested in? I mean, the practical reason for this is that such a global transformation can be described by only very few parameters compared to the number of pixels. So it doesn't scale, the number of parameters does not scale with image size. Yeah, I would just file this under practical side notes. Yeah. Okay. Now, and what we are dealing with in many cases is the class of linear transformations. And in this case, T is a matrix, the transformation is a matrix multiplication. No? Okay. So what we the types of transformations that we are dealing with in our cases are translation, so it's a shift in the plane, rotation, scaling. I think all this is very self-explaining. An affine transformation is like such a tilt or so, or a perspective transformation. Yeah. And there is, I think we will come to this in a few slides, there's a list of these transformations in Zelizky's book. I think actually there are two of those lists in the book that list the different types of transformations and loosely their properties. So then there's a nice overview, and we'll also have this in a second. Yeah. So to look at a couple of specific properties, so the scaling transformation means that we multiply each of the components by a scalar. Uniform scaling means all dimensions by the same scalar. What is the opposite of that? Well, we can do a non-uniform scaling and, for example, only enlarge along one dimension, then everything looks a little bit squished. Okay, so mathematically, the scaling operation is a multiplication, a coordinate-wise multiplication. So we can express this as a 2x2 matrix S to scale the coordinates. Rotation is also not difficult and probably also not very new. The rotation equation is that we have some rotation angle theta, and we calculate the rotation as so x prime equals x times the cosine of theta minus y times the sine of theta, and analogously y prime equals x times sine of theta plus y times cosine of theta. And the more familiar form to write this is probably also as a matrix transform. So we have the original coordinates x and y and multiply it by a 2x2 rotation matrix, and we end up with the rotated coordinates. Okay. Yeah, we also already talked about translations. So this is a 3x2 matrix where we have no rotation. So we have here a unity matrix and then the translation factors here. Shearing transformations are maybe a little bit more rare. And affine transformations are full 3x2 matrix operations. So, and this is the most, yeah, okay, the degree of generality of these transformations can more or less be seen from the number of parameters that are involved. No? So the affine transformation is the most general type of transformation that sort of includes all the other ones. Okay. So to talk a little bit more about affine transformations, so they are combinations of linear transformations and translations. And yeah, so the properties which are maybe more interesting from an application point of view is, so lines are mapped to lines. Parallel lines remain parallel. Ratios are preserved. And if we are composing multiple affine transformations, then these properties do not change. So we say the set of affine transformation is closed under composition. Okay. Now, yeah, here's the table that I've mentioned. So this table is actually from the book. There are some drawings to sort of illustrate what these transformations are about. And then the shorthand for the associated matrices, the number of degrees of freedoms, and what these transforms are preserving. Yeah, okay, translation, the simplest type of transform. A rigid transform means that the Euclidean distances are preserved, so the lengths are preserved. This is what is responsible for the name Euclidean distance. The term rigid transform is maybe more familiar in the field of registration. No? When you heard about image registration, there are rigid and non-rigid registration algorithms for mapping one object onto another. Okay, then the similarity transform preserves angles. And then we have the affine transform that preserves parallel lines, and the projective transform. So we didn't have examples for projective matrices, but these are 3x3 matrices with 8 degrees of freedom. They preserve straight lines. Yeah? And in the most general case, if we are thinking about our pinhole camera model and so on, then we are certainly interested in projective transforms. Yeah? But oftentimes, if we have specific constraint applications, think of some industrial imaging tasks, for example, or some constrained motion. For example, in an industrial setting, then simpler forms of transforms are oftentimes convenient to assume because we're just saving these degrees of freedoms. So the less, like, if we have less unknowns, then the whole like processing pipeline is more robust. Yeah, that's the whole idea about it. Okay. Okay. So what changes if we go from an affine transform to a projective transform? I already mentioned we have now a full 3x3 matrix of parameters to estimate. And if we remember from last time, so we have X and Y, and we have a third coordinate W, which is like a scaling factor, because in the projective transform, we are unique up to scale. And these coordinates are mapped onto some other coordinates, x prime, y prime, w prime, by multiplication with this 3x3 matrix. Okay, and so what properties do we have? Okay, I already mentioned lines map to lines, so that is what is preserved. But we're losing the notion of parallel lines, so they are not parallel anymore in the perspective projection. Ratios are not preserved. Okay, but it's also closed under composition. Okay, this can be seen as a change of basis, okay? And the projective matrix is defined up to a scale. So that is what I meant with this W. Okay, so let's look back at our model. So we have the object, we have a relationship between the camera orientation, object orientation, and the mapping onto the image plane. Capital X, the world coordinates, then the extrinsic parameters. Let's have a look here. It's a 3x4 matrix. Translation is here in the rightmost column. And this is a rotation matrix, a 3x3 rotation matrix. And these are the intrinsic parameters, K. We have the focal length in X and Y direction. We have the shear. And we have the camera center offset U0 and V0. Yeah. Okay. And these are, so if we're talking about camera calibration, these are the parameters that we would like to determine. And in order to determine these parameters, we also need to have some known values. No? And this is typically a calibration target or calibration object or so, such that where we have known length at a known position in the scene, such that we have known values for X, Y, and Z. And from what the image looks like, we can also plug in known values here. So we thought that we have to solve a system of linear system of equations where these coordinates here are given in order to solve the calibration problem. Okay. we also already talked about the homogeneous coordinates. So this, if we're dealing with 3D coordinates, this allows to have everything in a matrix form. So the way how it is done is we take the rotation matrix, we add the translation, and this is all combined into one matrix. Okay, we already talked about this. Good. So let's talk about the extrinsic parameters a little bit more. So I talked about this already. Sorry for the mess. A point is a line. This is the scale ambiguity. That is why we have the parameter w. Let me jump over this. I wanted to say something else. Okay, now we're coming to the calibration task. So if we are looking at these values, yeah, we have the intrinsic parameters times the extrinsic parameters. So we have a matrix K times RT, and we can replace this. We can say, okay, the product of these two matrices is just a matrix M. Yeah. Why is this important? Because if we have known scene coordinates X and known image coordinates lowercase x, then the unknowns that we can actually determine from these equations are just the entries of such a sort of placeholder matrix M. Yeah, and this is a 3x4 matrix. So these are the entries of this 3x4 matrix. And we can, for example, say, well, let's find, or let's look for these parameters using linear least squares. No? I mean, unless we see the necessity to do something more elaborate, then this should be fine. Yeah. Okay. Linear least squares is probably known from line fitting or so, or some other class. So essentially, how does it work? We have a couple of noisy measurements, and we are looking for the parameters for a line model, for example. Yeah, we are assuming we are fitting a line. So we have the equation y equals mx plus b. The question is, what is m, what is b, such that we can explain our observations. The observations are x and y with the minimum error. So the error function, the objective function, is the sum over all observations that we have. Observation I minus, and now we have our model fit m times xi minus b. This error is squared. That's why it's called least squares. Okay, so this is probably known from the undergraduate study. We can rewrite this in matrix form. So we can write the unknown parameters m and b. We can collect them in a vector p. The observation and the sort of measurement matrix are collected in y and a, and we end up with a problem AP minus y squared as an error function. Yeah, and then we can, for example, we can solve it for p, which are our unknown parameters, by computing the derivative, and we end up with a transpose AP minus a transpose y equals zero. We solve for p by computing the pseudo inverse, and have a transpose a inverse a transpose y. So this is like a closed form solution for a least squares fit. This is probably known, right? Is it known? Why don't we, okay, quick check. If we have AP equals y, why don't we compute directly? Why don't we take the inverse directly on the other side?
The inverse may not exist, and if it does, it may be hard to calculate.
Okay, why should it not exist?
Because it's a similar matrix.
Sorry? Ah, okay, A could be singular, okay. What does singular mean?
The rows or columns are
Okay. Yeah, this would be okay. This I think in which is, I mean, it goes in a similar direction. Like it's sort of the same problem maybe, no? But in actually in pattern recognition or image processing in these types of fits, we never have a quadratic shape here, no? And why is this? Because the matrices are always constructed in essentially in the same way. So and all you said is correct, yeah? So I'm not challenging this in any way. So the matrices are always constructed in the way that you say, okay, along the y direction, I have my different measurements or different observations or whatever. Measurements or observations, pick whatever you need. And in x direction, you have your problem dimensions, yeah? So this is the dimensionality of the feature vector, or in this case, okay, this is a little bit boring because we're fitting a 1D, forget it, yeah? But typically, okay, and this type of setup leads to matrices that are never quadratic, no? Because why should your number of observations be the same as the number of problem dimensions? No, this would be poor coincidence. No? So, and therefore, this inverse direct, it doesn't work. Yeah. Okay. And the workaround here is what is here written. It's a so-called pseudo inverse. So you say, okay, if I have a situation like this, sorry, and I want to isolate the point P, then what I can do is that I multiply from the left the transpose of that matrix to both sides. Yeah, this is like a harmless operation. And the result of multiplying A transpose and A leads to a quadratic matrix. Yeah, so this is a quadratic matrix. Now we can argue, is it maybe, it could still be singular, right? Maybe or so, no? It's not immediately clear why it should not be singular, no? But okay, let's say it's not singular, then we can compute the inverse. So we can multiply the inverse of this matrix from the left side. So this means this cancels into a big identity matrix, which we can forget. And we have on the other side the A transpose A inverse A transpose Y. Yeah, okay. And this is the usual way of doing a least squares fit. So this vanishes then, and we have our values for P. Okay, and this is what is shown here. Okay. And this is a very common thing, yeah? This is why MATLAB has a dedicated notation for performing this operation with this backslash, which sort of underlines like how common it is in this like data processing type of field. Okay. Do you have a question? No. Okay. Okay. So, sorry? Okay. Yeah, okay, so this is illustrated. You can make up arbitrary examples, like for example here, a translation, no? If you like to do a least squares fit to determine the translation of an object, what you need as input are matched, like are pairs of matched points. And then you can say the translation parameters are the unknown parameters, and you can directly set up a least squares problem. So the unknown parameters are the translation in x direction, translation in y direction, and the measurements are the offsets between your matched points in the sets A and B. Yeah, and you can take the differences between them, because this is, I mean, what translation is actually, no? The difference between one position and another. Okay, and then you do again, you compute your pseudo inverse and solve it. Okay. With rotation and scale, in principle, it could be done in the same way. Yeah. But then the problem quickly gets out of hand. Sorry, solving for translation. Okay. The problem gets quickly out of hand when we are dealing with real world images on arbitrary transform, perspective transforms, in particular. And maybe the easiest benchmark case to show that this naive type of least squares fit cannot work is when we think about vertical lines. Yeah. So if we have a line model that is it T or B or so? I don't know. If we have a model for the line that is represented here with the slope M, then what we can certainly not perform is a fit for a vertical line. Yeah, it's just not in our model, because then the slope grows to infinity. Another problem is that it's not rotation invariant. Yeah. So one way out here is to use a similar but slightly different approach that is called total least squares. In total least squares, what you're looking for is a line that minimizes the distances of the points to the lines. Yeah. So the naive line fit runs into problems, but in total least squares, we have a very general tool. So a tool for minimizing the distance distances of points to lines. So it's a small difference only, but this is actually the approach that is usually taken. No, okay. So we can say the distance of a point xi yi to a line represented in three coordinates A, B, and C is just AXI plus BYI plus C. So which essentially makes use of the normal onto that line. And then this can be directly inserted also in a least squares formulation. It's the same thing. And again, we can compute the derivative of this expression, and then look for an extremal point of this derivative. So the minimization problem eventually is minimize P A transpose A P, normalized by its size, so divided by P transpose P. Yeah, okay. And the solution to this is that you do an eigenvalue decomposition of A transpose A and look for the smallest eigenvalue, because yeah, it's a minimization problem, and pick the corresponding eigenvector. Okay. So here's a small overview slide that maybe summarizes this a little bit. Yeah. So one common type of setting up optimization problems is this like direct direct least square solution that we first looked up. So we have a problem of the type AX minus B squared, and we can solve it with the pseudo inverse. And a similar but slightly different type of problem statement is that we have a minimization problem of X transpose AT AX with the constraint that X transpose X equals 1. And the task to solve this is to look for a non-trivial least square solution to AX equals 0. So you perform an eigenvalue decomposition, look for the smallest eigenvalue, and pick the corresponding eigenvector. No? Okay, so that's the technical side of solving this. And it has a lot of advantages to do this, because so the main advantage is that it's not hard to understand, and it's also easy to implement. Yeah, up to this MATLAB-like shortcut for the solution, even in the case of the first example. Yeah. On the other hand, it's not the best type of solution. So more robust are actually iterative solutions that approach, like that, get much closer to the optimum. Then you can put in properties that outliers are not so much weighted. For example, this is a notorious problem of the least squares approach. So if you assign a squared weight to outliers, then a single point that is far outside has a huge error weight, just because the error goes in quadratically, yeah? And this is something, for example, the choice of the weight function is something that you can very easily change if you have an iterative optimization approach, yeah? As opposed to such a closed form solution. Okay. And if you have a look at the book by Zelisky, there's also an example for an iterative solver. It stays at a relative, like, abstract level, so it doesn't really go through all the details, no? But they mention it, no? And then you can solve individually for all components of this matrix M, so the intrinsic and extrinsic parameters separately. Okay, we can talk about this later. Okay, now let's talk about some actual calibration. So how do we obtain our known coordinates? We can say we place in the scene markers at known positions. Yeah, and we can say we also know the size of these markers, for example. We know the positions of these markers and so on. So we have all types of prior knowledge that allow us to determine then the global these world coordinates X, which are then multiplied by some unknown matrix M to end up in the image coordinates. Yeah. Okay. So here symbolized in red are the world coordinate system, yeah, and in green is our image coordinate system. And we need either an automated detection procedure or some manual annotations that such that we recognize, oh, this marker is in the real world the marker on the trash bin. Yeah. So it can be assumed to be at this and that position. Yeah. Okay. So this means so the trash bin, for example, the marker on the trash bin, that's a case of a known geometry. Yeah. So we know this like a target there and there, no? And then we're looking for a correspondence between image points and 3D points. For example, using the least square stuff that we just talked about. Okay, so concrete, this means, okay, we have the image coordinates. These are two scalars, no? And we have our known world coordinates. This is like a three-component vector as an input to our system of equations. How do we obtain these mappings? How can we practically obtain this association that, for example, this image coordinate corresponds to this world coordinate? How can we do this?
I think it's depending. For example, you can use, if you have like features who are incorporating like a larger neighborhood, mm-hmm. you can like identify these as you need, mm-hmm. for example, or you use like the correlation between different from the pattern.
So let's say each of these checkerboards were unique. For example, the color were unique. Yeah, like this red, this green, and so on. Yeah. Okay. How can we then, like, practically, if your task were to propose a processing pipeline to do this association of image coordinates to world coordinates, what could this pipeline look like? Okay, we didn't even talk about RANSEC, but okay, let's use RANSEC. But what feature representation? Yeah. We can also talk about RANSEC, of course, but it's maybe a little bit unfair because we did not mention it even yet. Hold on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we make a project and get a distance between the two-dimensional, and so we can get relative position between these two.
This would be cool, but it would also be quite complicated. But I like the proposal. So you're saying you can set up, you know the 3D coordinates anyways, no? So you can essentially define a graph of 3D. Like distances in your 3D world, and then look for a projection, I assume, yeah, of these distances onto the 2D picture. That would be cool, yeah. And it would be the solution to the whole problem, probably, as well, yeah. But let's really, what I'm interested in is the image processing part a little bit more. So what do I have to do in order to find out, I don't want to do this manually, right? So what do I have to do to find out, oh, at this and this pixel is pattern number 4 or so, I don't know, yeah? Which would be then this world coordinate, yeah? In terms of image processing, how would I find this out?
Is the question how to extract the feature points?
Yeah, sorry. Okay. The question is how to extract the feature points. Yeah, okay. How can we do this?
Yeah. There's different point features introduced, like serve or whatever.
Okay, 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 so okay. I think we need one.
No, you can use anyone. Serve is cool, but it's not properly.
Okay, okay, okay.
Corner detection?
Mm-hmm. We can apply a corner detector, right? We talked about the Harris corner detector, yeah? And we will probably find these points. We will also find a couple of other points. What could we do to filter out the wrong matches? Just propose a couple of things. Sorry? Thresholding on what? Sorry?
After the corner detection, we have K points.
Yes.
So then we can do thresholding.
But on what? On what would we threshold? Ah, yeah, okay, okay. This would reduce the number of corners, right? We have the eigenvalue criterion, the lambda 1, lambda 2, and we know both need to be large in order to have a real corner. And we can assume with such high contrast patterns, the eigenvalues should be really spectacular, no? In their magnitude. Okay, good. What can we do about the... Did we use all information already that we have available?
We can use MSER, if the shape is always the same.
Mm-hmm.
That we try to match the certain pattern that we're looking for. So,
mm-hmm.
Whereas, for example...
Yeah, you can use a template detector, no, to make sure it's really this type of pattern. And the other thing is, if we say each of these patterns here is distinct by its color, no, then we would also expect that we have some type of lookup table or so that we know, okay, the colors that appear in the scene in the calibration patterns are, for example, red, green, blue, and so on and so on. So we could also set up a criterion that says then, okay, if I'm going here in a circle, it should flip from one of these very pronounced colors to white, then back to that color and again to white, something like this. No? Would be like an additional, almost free criterion. No? And then we would say, okay. And then if we still have false matches, then we can talk about the Ransack algorithm, which we will do next week. Okay, yeah. Right. So this would be like a practical implementation of such a pipeline. And then we have these point correspondences. No? And we solve such a linear system of equations, for example, to obtain the calibration parameters. Okay. Right, so the least squares task, I think we talked about it a couple of times already. We have the 3D points in the scene. We're looking for a matrix M, such that we have an as good as possible mapping onto the actual 2D points. Yeah. Okay. Best M means, okay, P prime equals P, or if we prefer our eigenvalue type solver, then we would say P prime minus P equals zero. This is the desired solution. Okay, good. Now the details, they are super technical. I wouldn't want to read all these variables now, but it essentially, I mean, you're also familiar with linear equations, right? So we have these 12 unknowns, and now we can sort of split this up in a number of isolated equations for SU, SV, and S, so for these rows, and then reshape these equations, let me jump, such that we order all expressions in the unknowns, yeah, such that we have M11, M12, M13, M14, and so on. Then, okay, here's a gap, and then we have M31, M32, M33, M34 here, yeah? So if we have them in order, then we can write this as one vector of unknowns and have our linear system of equations. Okay, and this looks like that then. So these are the unknowns. These are the observations in the image, the 2D image coordinates u1, v1 until un, vn. And these are the 3D points in the scene. It's like a super wide matrix here. And yeah, if we take the numbers then from the scene, we can plug it in and just solve it. No? Okay. Tick, tick, tick. Okay. Good. So how many unknowns do we actually have? Yeah, I mentioned already last week that the number of unknowns is actually not just the sum of all these entries, because it turns out that some entries are not really required. So the true number of unknowns is 5 for the intrinsic parameters and 6 for the extrinsic parameters. Yeah, and this is like 3 translation parameters and 3 rotation parameters. Here, this is what constitutes the 6. You can also think about it in terms of the matrix M. So the matrix M has 3x4 entries. So these are 12 entries. But one entry is our projective scale ambiguity. So this also makes 11, which is also like 5 plus 6. So no matter how you look at it, these are 11 unknowns. Okay. So this means how many, in terms of our calibration pattern, or the many calibration patterns scattered around the scene, how many of those do we need? Well, if we have 11 unknowns, this means we need 6 corresponding, so 6 pairs of points, yeah? Because this gives us 12 lines in this linear system of equations, and then we're good. If we have more, of course, then we can always use the excess correspondences to have a more robust fit. Okay. Good. So, yeah, and then we just solve it. So, there's a lot of text on this slide, but it essentially only says we can either set up a linear system of equations of the type AX equals B. No? So the matrix here has entries M11 until M33, and the fourth one is omitted. Or we can set up, it's going to be a minimal change to the next slide, a linear system of equations of the type AX equals 0. So that means we subtract. Let me go back and forth again. So this means we subtract what is here the B, we take it on the other side and subtract it here. Yeah, like we have another column here with the minus B, and then we have the zeros here. And compute our SVD solution on this. So again, we have these two variants of solving the linear system of equations. Okay. And similar discussion as with the least squares before. So the advantage to use this linear method is it's relatively easy in a way if you're used to these algebraic methods. The The problem is that we actually, we only, up until now, we only have these surrogate parameters, M. Yeah, we don't have a decomposition into the intrinsic and extrinsic parameters yet. So we need some further processing in order to obtain this. And we cannot include any special wishes, yeah? Like, for example, radial distortion, we cannot put it in the model. Or if we, for example, know focal length, we cannot put it in the model because we are estimating M and not K directly, yeah? And the focal length would be an entry of K. So the intrinsic parameters K, but we cannot put this in. Yeah. So again, we can also use nonlinear estimators. Then we can also, for example, estimate all these matrices separately. We can put in our constraints and so on, but they are more expensive and they are more sensitive to local optima, probably. So a very common strategy is actually to combine both, yeah? To say, okay, why don't we start with a least KVS solution to have an approximately, like a good starting point, yeah? And we use this as an initialization, and then we can run 2, 3, 4 iterations of a nonlinear method to refine the parameters in the end. Like, this is really such a super standard approach in the vision community. Like, you cannot write it in big enough letters, no? If you like to get something like a robust system running, this is the standard way to go, not just for calibration, like for a lot of things. Okay. Good. Yeah, now let's talk 2 or 3 more slides about how we can separate M into an intrinsic calibration matrix K and an extrinsic calibration matrix RT. Yeah. So so there's a direct solution, but it's rather technical and not fun to look at. So let's not do this. But let's look instead at another solution that is also quite elegant and doesn't involve so much manual effort. And this is a so-called RQ factorization. Yeah? And the name is a little bit stupid because there's also a numerical task that is called QR factorization, but it's something else. So an RQ factorization means we are decomposing a matrix A, let's say, into an upper triangular matrix and some other matrix. Yeah. And this is actually exactly what we need, yeah? Because the upper triangular matrix, so this is the, these are the intrinsic parameters. And this other matrix will be our extrinsic parameters. So yeah, so R is a right diagonal matrix. This is the K, and the matrix Q. So on an orthogonal basis, this will be our rotation matrix. Okay, and then we can compute the translation matrix T, or the translation matrix T, from, so essentially taking K and R, sorry, taking K out of M and looking at the last column of it, right? So if we say, is that clear? If we say M equals K R T, then what we can do is we can compute K inverse M equals RT. And then if we wonder what T is, we just look at the last column. Okay, there it is. So this is illustrated here. So okay. This is the matrix Q that we obtain from the RQ factorization. If we know the matrix K already, Q is K times R. If we compute, if we are looking for M4, so the rightmost column, we have to take the calibration K out. K inverse M4 is T, I'm confused. This is referring to the camera center. Yeah. So we have, okay. Q is K times R, right? If minus Q inverse M4, okay, we have M4. We take the intrinsic calibration out. We take R out and then have the camera center C. Why is that? Isn't that contradictory to our previous slide? All right, let me think about this. This is the last slide anyways. So I'll fix this next time. Next time we will use, so the calibration is establishing a link between a 3D world coordinate and the camera coordinates. Yeah. Next time we will extend this. So we are going to work with two cameras and establish the relation between two cameras using an object in the world, and also look at the sort of inverse problem. If we know the relationship between two cameras, then we can use it to figure out where the object in the world is, which is like a stereo camera system, and it uses maybe the most well-known concept in computer vision at all, the so-called epipolar geometry. So this is a concept that relates multiple cameras and points in the scene. Okay, good. Any questions? Okay, then next week is back, right? If next week is back, then next time will be in 2 weeks. Yeah, so of course we're not lecturing. Sorry? Pfingsten, yeah, okay.